Okay, good morning, colleagues. Welcome, audience, to this, what are we, April 26, 2013, meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. I'd like to thank you all for being here this morning. This should be a very interesting hearing. Please, if you're feeling any hatred about being here this morning, direct it at me, please, not at either the Secretary of State or OUS. Okay. Today, we will be hearing about the Secretary of State recent audit of OUS and OUS's response. And Gary, I hope you'll also hang around if there's any response you need to make. So with that, I'm going to open this informational hearing on the Secretary of State's recent audit and call up Gary Blackmer, please.
Morning, Chairman Dumbrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Director of the Audits Division of the Secretary of State's office. With me is Amelia Evelyn. She is one of the, she's a senior auditor, worked on the audit. It's a large audit, so I needed to have someone come along because of all the details in it in case you have particular questions. But thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about this audit. It's a large audit, as I said, because we looked at many aspects of the costs of a college education. It's entitled The Oregon University System, Opportunities to Control Costs, Improve Student Outcomes, and Clarify Governance Structure. We selected this audit topic because of the large increases in the cost of a college degree, as well as the importance of a college education to the economic well-being of Oregon. It's a large report because it covers many aspects, and we looked at how well the university system is managing those costs. And while we found some positive activities, we also found many places where better information and more effort could control rising costs and improve student outcomes. I'll go through the report very briefly in terms of the kind of the key areas, but we're more than happy to answer questions in each of these. Tuition and fees. When we looked at tuition and fees,
Do you want questions at the end?
If you need clarifying questions, if that's okay, Mr. Blackmore.
Sure.
More probing questions. Let's wait till the end for that.
Thank you.
Okay. And let me also say that we have. Vice Chair Huffman is on the phone, and Representative Greenlick will be joining us by the phone.
Great, thank you. Resident tuition and fees increased faster than inflation and increased more than the loss of state funding between 2001 and 2012. OUS's current financial tracking reporting makes it difficult to understand how many resources are actually being directed to educational activities, and we recommended better tracking of those costs and the spending associated with it. Student debt. What we saw was that Oregon graduates or OUS graduates on average had 9% higher debt than the national average for the classes of 2005 through 2010. In addition, the heaviest cost burdens fall on those with the lowest incomes. However, OUS does not report or track the 35% of students who fail to graduate with a bachelor's degree within 6 years or who started another institution and graduated OUS. And we made recommendations around tracking the unmet needs and debt for all students and aligning programs to provide access and reduce student debt for those most in need. Regarding research costs, tenure and tenure track faculty at OSU, PSU, and U of O are expected to conduct research, and non-sponsored costs are absorbed within the department budget. The sponsored costs, such as federal funding, are tracked and reported separately. Universities do not track the amount of time that faculty spend on all their research as opposed to teaching, advising, and other duties. And we recommend that they begin accounting for all their research-related activities. Regarding financial accountability, Oregon universities have taken some steps to control their costs, but the efforts and results are varied. We find that in some programs, in some departments, some universities, activities are happening that we think are good, but it's not done in a systematic way. Budget reports and analyses are not presented to decision makers in a way that aids evaluation and financial management. OUS universities need to track, report, and evaluate costs across all levels of higher education in order to prioritize spending and improve financial decision making. Regarding personnel costs, and these include the salaries as well as the benefits, these happen to be OUS's largest expenditure. And what we saw was that the Chancellor's Office cannot analyze the actual personnel cost trends in detail without relying heavily upon individual universities. As a result, it cannot control most of the costs related to health and retirement. It cannot control those, and we recognize that, which are driven by PERS in the state. However, we think that there are personnel costs in terms of the number and type of employees, as well as their job functions, that could be better managed by universities and centrally. We recommend that OUS and its universities should closely monitor and routinely report on all personnel costs. Regarding costs and enrollment, what we saw was that the OUS universities are relying on increased enrollment to help balance their budgets, especially from non-resident students. However, they really don't track the full cost of the increasing enrollment. For example, they can calculate the average cost for a student, but they often do not include costs associated with increased capacity, such as debt service or new capital construction. In addition, admittance of non-resident students has increased, while admittance of resident students has slowed, in some cases decreased. And from our standpoint, just we have a concern that that trend may not be sustainable, and ultimately those debt costs and other fixed costs may need to be borne by a smaller pool of students, which could further increase education costs. So we recommend that OUS and its universities should create a comprehensive enrollment and financial management strategy. Regarding the graduation rate, Oregon universities admit applicants that are less prepared for college and less likely to graduate. Performance metrics do not represent the entire student body. For those it does track, OUS has steadily improved the number of degrees granted each year. But apart...
Excuse me. You can't hear, Mitch?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. I can hear you. I'll put it on mute. I'm sorry, Mike.
Okay, thank you.
Could have been worse.
Welcome, Mitch. Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry, Gary.
Hi, with Mitch.
Apart from the University of Oregon and Oregon State University, the six-year OUS graduation rate is below the national average for similar institutions. Oregon is less likely to achieve its 40-40-20 educational goal if OUS universities do not increase their graduation rates. We recommend that OUS needs to better assess the effectiveness of student assistance programs and report performance metrics of all students. Lastly, on governance, we
Mr.
find...
Mr. Chair, I have to stop right there and ask a clarification.
Sure.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Rep.
Your last, Director, your last statement said that you have to increase graduation rates or that the financials don't work. Is that what I'm...
Chair Dembrough and Representative Wisnant, what we talked about was the state goal of 40-40-20.
I don't see that in your report, any page. Is that in the report?
That is, yes, sir.
What page is that?
I'm sorry, Representative, I missed that.
He said that we have to increase our graduation rate, so that's performance. We're talking about performance-based, you know, issues, and I didn't see that, and I did not read every page, I'm sorry, but I did go through it and didn't see anything that I would have liked to see that to be a highlighted area, but go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Well, I'll have Amelia find that.
Because I agree with you completely. Mm-hmm. I don't see that in the report. Thank you.
Regarding governance, the current structure of governance over the university system risks creating confusion and a lack of accountability. Effective governance creates and monitors the performance objectives that are linked to goals, policies to improve education results, and clear lines of responsibility. However, we found overlapping responsibilities among the Oregon Education Investment Board, the Board of Higher Education, and the Higher Education Coordinating Council. There are three sets of overlapping performance measures with different reporting structures. In fact, we had a difficult time trying to determine where we should direct some of our recommendations simply because of that mix of responsibilities. We recommend that governance and authority over higher education needs to be clarified. We spoke about the Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnant. On the bottom of page 58, we talk about the challenge of meeting the 40-40-20 goal with graduation rates as they currently are, with some of the demographic and other issues that we think are going to make it a challenge for Oregon.
Thank you.
With that, that's a very brief run-through of our audit report. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you. I have about five short ones, I hope. Director, the objective of the audit, I completely agree with. That was Secretary of State or your own department's initiative. We didn't give you a bill or anything to do that, correct?
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnant, that is correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
There was no legislative input in suggesting what you look at.
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnant, no, we had done an audit about 2 years ago about managing faculty workload, which we considered a large component of the cost of an education. With this one, we wanted to look more broadly and see if there were other areas as well. So this was essentially a follow-up as well as an expansion of the issue around education costs and quality.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Director, I read that it is a performance audit, not a financial audit. Did you consider having outside expertise part of your team, like the Western Institute Commission of the Higher Education or the Education Commission of the States, who have looked into a lot of other universities and could have been an asset to your team? Did you consider
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnant, we looked at many of the reports that the research groups have done around the country, and we based a lot of our work on data that the universities had developed for the federal reporting system as well as their own internal documents, and we looked at the kinds of questions and aspects identified in those. I believe that we have a good and very talented staff to be able to match the methodologies of those other groups.
Final question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Director, could you give us an estimate on how many hours were spent on the audit and what it cost?
I would estimate that it was probably about, we could give you the exact
number.
I'd
like that, please. Thank you.
Okay.
Rick Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page one of the summary, the statement in here says that Oregon's current education governance structure structure risk creating confusion and a lack of accountability. There is an overlap in roles and authority between the OEIB, the HEC, and the State Board of Higher Ed. You haven't elaborated on that. Do you have any specifics in exactly where you see overlaps and what your recommendations would be for governance restructuring? That is a very pertinent topic for us, and that's why I ask that.
I understand. Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, toward the back of the report, we point out that they have multiple performance measurement systems in place. There's also a lack of clarity on who actually has the budget authority and accountability. And so those were what we thought were two key elements of accountability and direction that there was some confusion around that. And from our standpoint, as auditors, we feel like accountability is one of the key elements of a successful organization. And without that unity of setting expectations, and just as importantly, the follow-through to make sure that what is expected is actually accomplished. Those two things are really important. And with multiple boards involved, we felt like there was a higher risk of that unity of being lost.
And if I could just jump in, of course you've caught us at a moment in history where we hope things are as confused as they're going to be.
Right.
I mean, we had a system through the process of the Senate Bill 242. We made some changes, moving the system away from being a state agency. At the same time, and not deliberately, a new structure was created, the OEIB, as we were creating the HEC. And yeah, we're all confused right now. We're trying to sort it out. You would recognize that, wouldn't you?
Chair Dimbrough, that's correct.
Sorry, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You also talk about their bring to light the debt service funds and increases there over time. Could you elaborate there? And are you asserting or perhaps suggesting that our universities are putting a greater percentage of their budget into capital rather than people, rather than students? Is that perhaps what you're trying to allude to? But could you just shed a little light on what your data is all about?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Johnson, yes, we did see an increase in debt service funding from 2001-03 to 2011-13. It went from 3% of the money received by the universities to 13%. We understand that, you know, growth and expansion requires new construction, but ultimately it also takes money away from that could be used for teaching. So it was more in the background that we pointed that information out. But it is a challenge in an organization that's hoping to increase enrollment as a means of keeping its costs down.
Could I just follow up on that? Is there some sort of standard ideal of where you want to have debt service as part of an organization's budget? I mean, if you're looking at school districts or other entities, is there a sort of best practice there that we should be shooting for? I know your concern is that it's not really being handled strategically, but if we were handling it strategically, is there a threshold we should be shooting for?
Chair Dimbrough, on the construction side, it's a little more difficult because in a changing organization, there may be expansion requirements. On the maintenance side, that should be predictable, and it should be something that money is routinely set aside in order to extend the life of your current facilities as long as feasibly possible. So there are standards on the any kind of capital spending to fix and maintain and preserve a facility, but not necessarily on when something new is constructed. So I don't have any guidance, and I have not seen any ever on that topic.
Thank you. Yes,
go ahead. A couple more came up. I'm sorry. Director, I look at the scorecard in the back, and we had 12 agrees and 8 disagrees on your recommendations. And I believe in our previous conversations, you don't follow up on those or come back and say, let's discuss them or even see if they comply. Is that our job? Is that our leaders of the university system that have to do that? My experience in the military on audit teams is they have to report every 90 days on how they're progressing on recommendations until it's done, or you lose your job as a wing commander. So we don't do that, I don't think, in your business. Is that correct?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Wisnett, we selectively follow up. And to a certain degree, this is a follow-up on our previous audit on faculty workload. So we ask each organization what they have done to implement, and then we will go out and conduct reviews strategically. We've done them of Department of Revenue, Oregon Commission for the Blind, and some other areas where we did do follow-up. And so it's on a strategic basis as opposed to going out and spending audit hours just looking specifically at every recommendation we make.
Follow up to that. Yes. I don't see that in the report where you said this is a continuing problem. Is that documented in the report that we saw this last time, or we think this is still a failure in leadership? And did you look at when your audit did you look at how we fund and how the special services parts of the university system are managed and function? like the agriculture research centers and things like that. Did you go that much in detail?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Wisnant, no, we did not. We focused on the educational portion of it. And we did talk about the our earlier audit was issued in 2011, and the title of that one was Oregon University System Improved Management of Faculty Workload. And several of the recommendations in here and the same issues were raised in this one that were in that one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Rick Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be willing to turn to page 38? Possible. And you talk about the personnel costs and how.
Somebody's got their unmute.
Thanks, Chair.
Mitch, in more than one hearing.
Somebody's listening.
Looking back into the
and as you can hear, people, we are being live streamed. But with a slight delay.
Just turn them way down.
Somebody's got their.
Now that we should turn up. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. What I'd like you to maybe shed some light on, just expand on, is the data you have in here about the increase in personnel costs over the last decade or so, and how we compare nationally with other like university systems.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson, yes, we did see that there was a large increase in the personnel costs relative to other universities. Basically, what we saw was that the pension and health benefit costs were some of the largest drivers of that relative to the other universities in the country, there was a, there was a 20% of the salary within OUS is spent on retirement relative to 10.9% on the average for other public universities. Similarly, healthcare contributions were about $9,200 for those other universities, and for OUS it was $14,600 per faculty member. So those were significant contributors to the increase in the personnel costs.
Can I just jump in, Mr. Blackmore? Could you? So those increases, though, are probably comparable for all of state government, no? I mean, if you're singling out OUS, is that really fair?
Oh, Chair Denbrough, you're correct. This is what we've seen other agencies in the state experience as well. We know that there's another pension system that the university system has. We haven't looked into that to understand what that has to do with the cost, but apparently they have an option of another one. But we were just putting all the pension costs together.
Because for me, one of the sad ironies would be that I think our average salary compensations are lower than many of our peers or competitors across the nation, if you will, yet our personnel costs have escalated and actually could be higher. So it's something obviously we need to deal with. And I know noticed that in your recommendation you say that OUS encouraged them to work with the state to better control its PERS and PEB costs. And obviously you're aware that that's not something it's necessarily easy for OUS to do unilaterally. And maybe you're aware, maybe you're not, but I think they've also, you know, I know Jay Kenton's here, he'll probably talk to this later, but it's, you know, run the numbers and so forth, and it has a report that if OUS could self-insure, they could save many, many millions of dollars and so forth. So it's not like they haven't done their work. I think if there's a shortcoming there, it's on the part of others within the government who has basically said, no, you're going to have to stick with what you're doing now. So thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
The alternative retirement system that they have, is that what percentage of the people are involved in that, and is that for higher staff people or leaders of the system? I was not aware of that.
Chair Denbrough, Representative Wisnant, I'm not very familiar with it either.
Maybe Mr. Keaton.
We can hear about that.
Thank you.
I think Vice Chancellor Kenton can address that. Thanks. Okay, I have a few questions. You know, just this morning there was an article in Inside Higher Education about some controversy in the Wisconsin system over their reserves. and a difference of opinion as to what is the appropriate level of reserves. Is that something that you looked into here, the level of reserves that that the system is adopting?
Chair Dembro, we did not look at that specifically. I happened to see that article from the Journal Sentinel, and it raised a question with me, but I also, because of the way it was reported, I would have to look more specifically at their financial statements to see. There's always some, taking the financial statement that was reported in that newspaper was a snapshot on presumably June 30th, into their fiscal year. And there's always cash flow issues. So it's not necessarily a reserve so much as it's money that's there to cover until the next tuition payments come in from the students. So we'd have to look at that in more detail to see whether something similar like that was happening here in Oregon.
There too, is there some sort of ideal that you try to shoot for, in terms of what's an appropriate level of ongoing reserves? I'm not talking about sort of cash flow issues to carry you through the summer or whatever. Is there sort of an average annual that you want to try to hit?
Chair Dembro, that's a very good question. We struggled with that on trying to figure out what Oregon should have for a rainy day fund. It has to do with the predictability of revenues and expenditures, that if there's high fluctuations in revenues or expenditures, then you need a larger reserve. If they're relatively stable, you can predict kind of the worst case scenario and just have enough for that. But to the degree that it would take a major kind of an analysis to determine the predictability of the university's revenues and expenditures and be able to kind of determine what's a good safe reserve to have to deal with the unexpected.
Right. But you would probably agree that that should be a strategic decision made by the boards, right?
Chair Dembro, that's correct.
Yes. So we're living in a post Senate Bill 242 world now. Obviously, things are changing, but for now, we're starting to find our way within that environment. Do you have an assessment, in doing your audit of whether this was the correct decision for us? Were we right 2 years ago to go down this path and devolve more authority to the system and to the individual universities?
Chair Dembro, I know that there are many factors that this committee and public officials are considering around the governance of the university system. From our standpoint, we're looking at what's happening in the classrooms and the research labs on the campuses and trying to figure out how best they can serve their mission. How it's governed is kind of a little distant from our purview. We know that successful organizations set clear expectations and follow up to make sure that those expectations are accomplished. So I guess I don't know that we have the magic answer to all of this or even what might be better than others. I think we pointed out that if you've got overlapping and duplicating kinds of systems of governance and accountability, you're going to run into risk there that no one really is in charge. To the degree that that's, I think, a simple principle to think about. But beyond that, I guess I would hope that at least you keep in mind the recommendations of our audit and think about which structure would best help you ensure that our recommendations are followed through on. That ultimately, from our standpoint, is the most important criteria, but we understand that you have other ones under consideration. I can try answering a little more if you have any other questions, but I don't envy the position that you're in trying to sort out all the different factors involved.
Thank you. I have one last question. That's so you talked about the research component of the university mission, and that is an area where universities are differentiated. Right, we have you know, the three larger ones, which do a lot more research, particularly federally supported research, than the smaller ones. And they, you know, each of them has, you know, really a very distinct mission. And was that something that you looked into? And I don't know if you could speak to whether some are doing a better job than others of you know, tracking their work or, you know, doing their work according to the metrics that you're focused on. But can you speak about that in a sort of university by university kind of perspective?
Chair Denbrough, that's one of the challenges that we always have with these audits, because there are seven very distinct different universities in Oregon. I think they all serve a particular purpose. And for example, in our first audit, we found that in terms of tracking and managing faculty workload, the smaller regional universities actually had a better handle on it than the larger research ones. And part of it is that research was not tracked in a way that helped us relate that back to how that helped students. I think research is important for a variety of purposes, but again, from an accountability standpoint, we look at the three missions that the university have of education, research, and public service, and we would like to see how they are achieving those specific goals and what kind of efforts and resources are going into them. So from a research perspective, some of it may get back into the classroom. It may get into a graduate student's classroom, but does it get actually into an undergraduate student's classroom? Those are the kinds of questions we would ask to see, are undergraduate students subsidizing graduate research? Are there lower division classes that are actually much less expensive than upper division? Is that a proper way to manage all those funds? They put everything into the ENG fund, tuition, research, as well as the state general fund, and it's drawn out from there. So it makes it difficult for us to be able to distinguish which resources are going to which activities. And from our standpoint, that is an aspect of accountability and being able to say, this is what we've accomplished with these dollars, is essentially one of the missions that we're always asking ourselves, what can we do to see if that's being done as efficiently and as effectively as possible? So from the standpoint of each of the universities, some of them that are not involved in research are a little easier for us to see and understand what's going on than the larger universities that are involved in multiple missions that are blended together. And that's kind of where we started with faculty workload as a means of identifying, you know, a core mission of education and where tuition dollars are becoming a larger and larger share.
So obviously there are a lot of value judgments involved, you know, in these. I mean, if it were true that undergraduate education is supporting graduate education, maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe that's what we want, right?
That's correct, Chair.
The same thing with lower division and upper division. But it just needs to be upfront and deliberate and strategic. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Denbrough, I agree. I think that from our standpoint would help us, and recognizing those are the kinds of decisions that a governing body can make, that for the good of the organization, for the ability of students to grow and learn and have opportunities to work with an experienced researcher, that's all part of that mission. But being able to explain that and tie the tuition dollars to that kind of a value, we think is important.
And just pursuing that, you know, there's some debate over the extent to which the larger universities should be supporting the smaller regional universities, right? That's something we're wrestling with right now. You know, I think, you know, many of us feel very strongly that the integrity of the smaller universities needs to be maintained, you know, even if that is at the expense of the larger ones. I mean, that is, we have to think about what's good for Oregon as a whole. But again, just the fact, if it were true that the largers were supporting the smallers, that's not a bad thing. That's it. But again, it's a value.
It's Chair not Dembrough. Necessarily a good thing either.
Right.
It's a value call.
Yes.
And I respectfully don't agree with you fully in everything you said there. And that's where we somehow sort out these values. I would say it's not the job of the larger institution to support the smaller institution. It's the job of the state to support smaller institutions.
That's fair.
Chair Dembrough, I agree. I mean, I think there's values of having proximity of the smaller universities to the populations they're trying to teach. That's a hard trade-off. It's not something we auditors would ever step into and say, you know, we might point out you're subsidizing these universities more than others, but we'd also recognize the value of having an Eastern Oregon or a Western Oregon where the population can easily get to classes. So those are exactly the kinds of questions that I think you were elected to debate, and it's a good thing.
Great, thank you. And any further questions?
Mr. Chair, just one more.
Yes, and Rip Johnson.
I don't know whether it's a great answer to this or not, but again, as you you delved into the budget-making process within the institutions and so forth, and I don't know what page you're on here. It's got to be page 40. Replacing college-level budget authority at the level of deans or individual departments makes it difficult for universities to ensure that departments are aligning their budget with university-wide plans. And you talk about how there can be differences in each university within the budget-making process. Some have committees, some allow the deans or department heads to kind of submit their budget requests, and there can be some differences, I think, from university to university. Is that abnormal for a university system? I don't know the answer to that, but is what happens within OUS different than what perhaps happens in other state systems or within other state agencies, I guess, as we talk about, you know, from the agency perspective? I'm assuming you guys audit other agencies other than just, they're not an agency now, but OUS. So what kind of comparables can you give us regarding what happens within OUS?
Chair Dembrough, Representative Johnson, you raise a very good question. We approach the university system as we would any state-funded agency that, or any agency that falls within your purview, that we expect to see, you know, systems in place that explain where the money comes from, where it goes, how decisions are made, ensuring that the way that decisions are made cascades down and is consistently carried out. And we saw a wide range of ways of doing it. And also, again, it's an accountability issue that being able to roll that information up and consistently report on it depends upon all those things being done at the department level in a consistent way and rolled up. So those were some of the struggles we had in terms of that line of accountability that in many agencies, the head of the agency has a kind of a what they call a line of sight down to the frontline staff person, and there's consistency, and it's done in a way that helps ensure administratively that things are done in a clear and accountable way, and we did not see that carried out, and it's one of the struggles I think that the Oregon University system has in being able to report out what they're accomplishing, and there may be wonderful things that they're doing, but we're not able to see those either as well. So I think there's aspects of it that make it more difficult for them to achieve what they want, but it's also more difficult to show what they've accomplished.
Okay, thanks. Mr.
Chair. Yes, sir, please.
Thank you. Director, you and I have worked on other issues and other legislative sessions, and I respect the audit business completely. I find this audit unacceptable to your mission, to what you were required to do, which was try to find out how to bring costs down. And I could have told you how to bring costs down. You need to go to these people and ask them, you know, how do you tomorrow have a transferability credit of college credits that rises costs tremendously? You could have asked them, really look at full-time, part-time, look at granting credit for experience and things like that, and look at your cost of personnel, PERS, and your medical. And that's not addressed in this audit.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Wisnant, I think some of those things are, in terms of granting credit, for example, those are policy issues that we could certainly talk about what other universities do. I think some of them, the recommendations that you talk about in terms of how they manage their staff are, we almost have to get down to a university-by-university audit. And I think we may do that one next time. But at this point, we're trying to understand what
data
is out there.
Mr. Chair, there's data here that's good.
Well, those are issues we're going to be debating, Rip Wisnant, I'm sure. But before I let you go, Mr. Blackmore, I want to just sort of a philosophical, high-level question. I anticipate that in OUS's response, you'll hear reference to the term tight-loose. That's something that we seem to hear a lot about. And, claims will be that, well, we're living in a tight, loose world, and so just judge us by our outcomes and don't focus on, the granular detail of, how we're managing the operation. And how do you respond to that as an auditor?
That's a very good question. I've worked in organizations that I have performance measures and use those as a means of judgment, but I compare those to the dashboard of an automobile. Well, when something isn't working right in the automobile, you take it to a garage and they've got a computer that they plug it into, and it's much better at diagnosing detailed problems. For me as an auditor, I think we can use that computer to diagnose problems, to boost performance. Just looking at results doesn't necessarily say that better results can be achieved. So from my perspective, I think that it's always important to get inside, to audit, to look at how well things are operating internally, because it provides that assurance that you can get more, you can achieve more than just what you did last year. So I guess that would be my bottom line, is that I think that analysis, getting under the engine, using that metaphor to its end, is always an important aspect of governance, and that's something that we do and will continue to do.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'd just like to comment on the just recognize the difficulty in developing metrics for a university system where the mission is not just a cut-and-dried outcome. I mean, you're really dealing with faculty who need to be creative, a university needs to be creative, and so you're really trying to develop measures for a creative process without sort of stifling the creativity, and I think it's a really hard thing to juggle.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gallegos, I agree entirely. I think the measures are suggestions or indicators. They're not, they should never be mechanical in the sense that if you don't achieve this, we're going to take money away, or because I think we've seen the outfall from No Child Left Behind around the country in terms of the problems that arise when it becomes too much of a mechanical process. I would hope that the measures become a means of enriching the discussion around these services, that it's part of the vocabulary, not just words and anecdotes, but you've actually got numbers that help you see what you're accomplishing, but it's not the only thing. And I think that if there's any piece of advice I could give, I think you're right on that. You need to always approach these cautiously, that you may lose something in the process of gaining elsewhere.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you'll hang around in case we need you. Rep. Gallegos, I should point out that I just heard from Rep. Greenlick that great comment.
Thank you.
Okay. Were you going to come up by yourself? You want to bring up your whole
team? I'll bring up the team.
Yeah. Okay. If you can, we can squeeze four in there.
Here's the recommendations.
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us on this gorgeous morning. We appreciate the time. And for the record, my name is Melody Rose, and I serve as the interim chancellor of the Oregon University System. I'm going to very briefly give you an introduction and overarching comment about our remarks and then yield to my colleagues who will talk with you about various aspects of the report. And then I will bring it home by talking to you very specifically about cost savings measures that we are pursuing in the academic realms, some of the things that Representative Wisnat mentioned I'd like to get to at the end of our time with you. So first off, I think it's important for us to reiterate, as we've done in several venues, that we're very grateful to have a partnership with the Secretary of State's office. I attended every single one of the audit meetings over the course of the past many months, and I think the conversation that we had with Mr. Blackmer and his team was very productive and engaging, and we were able to partner on a whole variety of issues, and we are grateful for the report. There are many areas of agreement between OUS and this report, and we will be sure to underscore those for you before we leave this morning. One of the things I want to ensure all of you as we walk through this conversation, it is that is my personal commitment to you that the Chancellor's Office will strive for new heights of accountability and responsiveness and transparency, and that as we partner with the legislature in envisioning different forms of governance, it is really our commitment to help you and assist you with those considerations. There's one fact that I'd like to point out before I yield to my colleagues, and that is a reminder to all of you, and it won't be lost on you, that the budget we received today is actually lower than it was in the 1999-01 biennium, and that is in spite of the fact that we educate 34,000 additional students, the equivalent of another Portland State University. And that is the single largest cost driver to our price. And while there are many, many things that we can and will be doing to keep our controls tight and improving, I think it's not lost on us that there is a budget issue that we ask for your consideration with. So I'd like to turn now to Kirk Schuler, who is the chair of the State Board of Higher Education's Finance Committee.
Excuse me. Good morning, Chair Dembrough and committee members. My name is, for the record, is Kirk Schuler. I am the chair of the Finance Committee and a member of the State Board of Higher Education. I've been on that board since March 2009. Just for a little context, I'm a graduate of U of O with a degree in accounting. I worked for the international accounting firm of KPMG for 7 years as an auditor. Then I served as a controller, CFO, and president of Brooks Resources Corporation in Bend, and I currently serve as the chief administrative officer for St. Charles Health System in Bend. So I'm happy to be here this morning. It was a lovely drive last night. So I'll start by saying that the State Board of Higher Education accepts this audit report and appreciates the work that went into it. I'd like to take the time now to discuss the fundamental challenge presented within the audit and the role of the university system in terms of certain types of data collection and assessment in light of the current governance structure. This audit presents a worldview where the campuses report to the university system in a more granular way than they do now. And the university system has a much tighter centralized control, which would be probably seen as micromanagement by campuses. But that's what's presented in the audit report. Since the discussion of granting institutional boards and greater institutional autonomy in late 2011, it has been the goal of the State Board of Higher Education to determine what those optimal roles are between the campuses and the board and system office. Compared to our national peers, the Oregon University system is known nationally as having one of the least centralized systems. You know, but this has been a process that has occurred over the last 20 years. And that began changing in 2004 when the Chancellor's Office functions and staff were cut by 50%, with many of those functions moving to the campuses. And more recently, of course, with the move to create institutional boards for one or more of our campuses. While you will hear and we'll discuss areas where we differ in opinion about some of the issues highlighted in the report, I believe this audit underpins a fundamental issue we are grappling with in the state. As more Oregon families grow concerned about the cost of college education and outcomes become more and more important on a statewide level, the role of a statewide view that improves efficiencies and shares services remains essential, as does the role of the universities to do what they do, which is educate students. What we have always tried to balance are the optimal roles for the system and for the campuses. It's been a mission constantly as a board member. The audit's focus on cost is very important, and it's a key barrier to student success. We know that. You heard the Chancellor talk about that. But reducing costs is a collective effort. It's a collective effort of the campuses, the Chancellor's office, the legislature, PERS, PEB, and other stakeholders. It's quite dynamic. Discussions like the one occurring now with the State Board of Higher Education on shared services is one way that we can start to address some of those issues, and we take it very seriously, and we work very hard to try to identify those with that goal in mind. I fully support more discussion and work on cost savings because we're losing students now based on cost. We know that. It's a competitive business we're in. But the recommendations in the audit report, in my opinion, reiterate this shared problem but do not present a shared solution by all those who influence costs. In other words, it's an oversimplified solution to a highly complex problem. Cost drivers have been and will continue to be a focus of the board's work, and we look forward to working with our campuses to find solutions in the short term and also address any systemic issues that we can identify over the long term. It's what we do, and that's how we approach all of our discussions. As an example, I know that the Oregon University system is sponsoring an affordability and debt symposium in October, and in the words of a colleague, Jill Island, on the board, this is an action-oriented and not about admiring the problem. So that's how we hope to approach things and create solutions and actions. We're as adamant about getting the costs out of the system as the legislature is. We understand that that is critical to our success, given all the dynamics that we deal with. So that's the end of my comments. I would like to turn it over now to Western Oregon President Mark Weiss.
Thank you. Chair Dembro, representatives of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Weiss. I'm president of Western Oregon University. As a president who has followed probably the road least traveled to this position, I'm privileged to be a spokesperson here today. By way of background, I spent approximately 10 years also at the international accounting firm and consulting firm of KPMG Pete Marwick. And also about 20 years as the chief financial officer for Siemens Power Generation Company, a international firm. From my first day on the job at Western Oregon University, my leadership emphasis has been on continuous improvement and increased productivity of processes and finding new and innovative ways to find new revenue streams to supplement diminished state appropriations. This has allowed us to continue to our promise to Western students that began in 2007 that Oregonians enrolling at Western would not receive tuition increases during their 4 or 5 year education at Western, with over a 30% increase in state appropriations since 2007 to 2013. This has been a daunting promise, but one that we've kept and one that we've not reneged upon. Each university president, as part of the Oregon University system, is responsible for its own fiscal sustainability. Resources necessary to provide affordable education to Oregon, and Jay Kenton told me that on my first day on the job. If you see a cliff rise, if you're driving an airplane and you see a piloting an airplane, and you see a cliff rising in the foreground, you better do something about it. That's just what we all try to do. We at Western have coined our efforts of instilling a culture of continuous improvement at Western Oregon University as the window of opportunity, an acronym that is oddly called WOO WOO, at a time when we have some level of fiscal strength and we think that we're able to determine our future, we want to take advantage of being able to do just that. Our efforts involve the entire university community and are detailed on our university website for all to see, together with our goals and progress towards achieving those goals. I know that each president in the system takes their responsibility to assure fiscal stability just as importantly as I do. It is absolutely necessary and essential in delivering the promise of an education for Oregonians consistent with the state's goal of 40-40-20. My reading of the audit report left me with a few comments that I wish to share with you today. The report implies that universities do not have a good understanding of its cost drivers and faculty productivity. I respectfully contend that we do. Most of the universities have faculty unions and contracts, as we do, that are very specific as to workload requirements, and those are demanding and robust and well monitored by each individual institution. Many of the recommendations revolve around increased data capture and analysis for decision making. While it is hard to argue that the goal is not well intended, we must and do always weigh the cost and benefit of systems and personnel that are necessary to track that information versus the benefits derived. In fact, statistical data show that Oregon universities are consistently at the lowest percentiles in administrative costs comparisons nationwide. Earlier, there was mention of research institutions. Well, Western, as a smaller institution, has between $10 and $11 million of annual research that it is funded for. That compares to a budget, general fund budget, of about $55 million. We are a significant research institution comparatively. There is no gray area between what our teachers do with regard to teaching and scholarship and research, period. At Western, we have one financial analyst for our general fund accounts. However, in recent years, we have added significant resources to supplement student advising and success, writing assistance resources, early intervention monitoring systems, and added resources to assist our traditionally underserved populations for success. These investments are obvious needs and don't require much study. To study what is suggested would require a team of analysts and new systems. Lastly, we direct scholarship and remission dollars for those students with the most financial need, those students who otherwise would not have access to a university. In fact, last biennium, all system universities backfilled the Oregon Opportunity Grant for amounts that were diminished due to the challenging state economic picture. I thank you for this opportunity to provide a short list of comments and would now like to introduce Vice Chancellor Jay Kenton.
Thank you, Mark. Representative Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Oregon University System. I too would like to echo my appreciation for this audit and to the Secretary of State for this audit. It's timely and it raises many issues worthy of consideration and discussion. Before I address the audit in particular, I'd like to point out the management philosophy that we have operated with during my 30-year tenure in the Oregon University system, and particularly during my last 8 years as Vice Chancellor. First, we work in a very complex environment with many overlapping expectations, rules, and policies. Not only do we need to comply with state law, board policies, and OUS procedures, but we in our campuses also need to comply with multiple expectations and requirements from the federal government for the hundreds of millions of dollars of federal student aid, research, and other sponsored projects that are funded annually, and with myriad other donor, grantor, and contractor requirements with whom we work each year. You know, I'm a professor of public finance. I think I've told you that before. And I used to teach fund accounting for the National Association of College and University Business Officers. In fact, I sat on that board for many years as well. And each account requires a separate fund. Each grant requires a separate fund. And a definition of a fund is a separate set of books. You could do a balance sheet, you could do an income statement, you could do a statement of cash flows on every fund. We manage in excess of 15,000 funds a year. 15,000 separate sets of books. Luckily, we have systems that allow us to aggregate and consolidate, roll those up, etc. So it's complex, and there are many different expectations, requirements, reporting. Individual grantors want to know how their monies were used, etc. You want to know how your money is used. That's perfectly appropriate. That's what our systems were designed to suggest. In addition, the generally accepted accounting principles for college and universities are based on the following: the Government Accounting Standards Board. That applies to all state agencies. The National Association of College and University Business Officers, which actually publishes a FARM, the Financial Accounting and Reporting Manual, that gets into a lot of detail about how we are to do our accounting. And it does require that we account for non-sponsored research as an instructional expense. That's part of our generally accepted accounting procedure. We also comply with the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants Audit Guide for Colleges and Universities, forms part of our GAAP, if you will, generally accepted accounting principles. And then we also follow the U.S. Department of Education Integrated Post-Secondary Education Statistics Standards, IPEDS, which, you know, dictate that we have to have data in certain prescribed formats. This creates a complex set of expectations and sometimes overlapping and or contradictory requirements. Our accounting systems have been set up to accommodate the multitude of reporting requirements and generally have served us well. However, in certain instances, this makes data gathering and analysis complicated and sometimes very labor-intensive. I would like to point out, just for the record, that we have had clean audits in every year of my tenure in OUS. We get audited annually by the Secretary of State. Our financial statements do present fairly the results of our operations. We get audited annually by the federal government. We have program reviews on multiple grants and contracts. And for the most part, we've had clean audits there. I'm not telling you we haven't had problems, because we have, but generally we have done that correctly. In addition, the federal government requires that anyone paid on a federal grant and contract report on a monthly basis, actually maybe quarterly basis, on a personnel activity report, how they spent their time working on that grant or contract. Those things, some of you are shaking their head because you've probably done that. And they're cumbersome, they're time-consuming. Faculty don't necessarily like them, but we require that they do them nonetheless, as they're required by law. So we have this very complex environment. We have operated with a tenet of continuous improvement. And in fact, in the 80s and 90s, we were one of the first organizations in the state to adopt a total quality management, Baldrige, continuous improvement, and we have continued many of those practices today. This has resulted in good stewardship and has produced great efficiencies, especially in the lean financial times that we have experienced in Oregon, which started in the 1990s with the passage of ballot measure 5, and that persists today. Yes, necessity is the mother of invention. And the rankings of the Delta Cost Study, which show OUS institutions among the lowest cost degrees in the country, have been the result. This philosophy also ensures that taxpayer dollars are utilized prudently and student tuition is kept to a minimum. Our board has a goal of access and affordability for all qualified Oregonians. We care about student costs, but feel the price has been driven more by the reduction in state funding than increases in costs, especially in the costs that we can control. Second, we value transparency in our financial operations. OUS participates in the state transparency website before the passage of Senate Bill 242, and during the discussion leading to the passage of 242, we felt it important that we continue to participate in that transparency effort. Mike Green, the OUS controller, is a member of the Transparency Oversight Commission. So today you can go to the state's transparency website and obtain information about each of our institutions and the chancellor's office, revenues by amounts, expenditures by amounts and source, payroll and expenditures by type. We are managing public funds and have nothing to hide. Finally, we always endeavor to be responsive to information requests from the legislature, the media, the public at large. Our board reports are all publicly available on our website and openly discussed in public meetings that are open to the public and webcast over the internet. And I might add that I sit on a number of other boards, and I think OUS is exemplary in terms of the amount of detail that we provide board members and the information that we put on our website. Quarterly, we have budget to actual and projected to year-end amounts for all current unrestricted funds and general auxiliary designated operations. We project fund balances. I'll talk about one of the questions on reserve levels that came up in just a few minutes. We do that for all campuses and the chancellor's office discreetly, as well as the system as a whole. We go over investment results on a quarterly basis. We have risk management quarterly reports that show claims that have been filed, resolution of claims that have been in process, and other things by type of claim, be they workers' comp, liability, or property reports. And we have regular internal audit updates. Annually, the board approves an internal audit plan. We have a very active auditing department within the system. External audit results, including the discussion with the auditors, financial statement ratios, comparison to peer institutions in terms of cost per student, etc. Our presidents and chancellor are evaluated annually based on results, and in fact, some of the areas of focus include leadership, financial management, enrollment, degrees awarded, degrees in shortages, research, and it goes on and on. There are 15 different criteria, and this year, for the first time, we're adding five-year financial forecasts for Ed in general, complete with projected enrollment, tuition costs, and fund balance projections. I could also take you through the history. I'm going to cut this short just because we're running out of time. I could take you through a history of the devolution of responsibility that has occurred over my tenure. And it has occurred. It's been very intentional. And I think that we operate with a philosophy that decisions are best made closest to their impact. Many of our board members are industry leaders and others, and they believe they run their companies that way. They believe it's the best way to operate. So given this background, in my opinion, this audit poses a bit of a dialectic or a conundrum and presents a wonderful opportunity to debate the pros and cons of the following: central versus decentralized control, focusing on inputs versus focusing on outputs or outcomes, increasing use of incentives, all of which that we are involved in. But I would like to make one final note. To date, budget reductions have focused primarily on administrative operations in order to preserve academic capacity during this time of great growth in enrollment, research degrees, etc., and in pursuing the goals articulated in the 40-40-20 arena. This leaves OUS with a very lean administrative structure that must remain focused on value-adding and essential tasks. For this reason alone, we are leery of recommendations that require greater data analysis and reporting, especially if the value proposition of doing so is unclear or if it contradicts the operating premises outlined earlier. For many of our campuses, any new investments in administrative operations or further budget reductions will need to come from academic operations, which will compromise our ability to meet the 40-40-20 expectations that are vitally important to the future of this state and its citizenry. So I'd like to now go back to some of the questions that came up during Gary's presentation and just talk briefly about that, with your indulgence,
yes, please,
Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett asked about our optional retirement plan. It is an optional retirement plan that we offer to unclassified faculty and staff at our institution. It's a one-time election. When you're hired, you can opt into it, or you can, if you don't make an option, you can default into PERS. It is a defined benefit plan, which has the benefit of never having an unfunded pension liability, never, because what we give them is what they have. 30% of our faculty choose that. We have that combined with our deferred comp plan, over $1 billion under management in those plans. It works very well. We have a bill in front of this body this time. The rates have been coupled to PERS. We're asking through Senate Bill 269 that those rates be decoupled. We're also asking that the eligibility criteria change. The eligibility currently are also linked to PERS and a couple other minor housekeeping details. But it's a very different plan, and it's a defined benefit or defined contribution plan. It really should not be linked to a defined benefit. They're two very different types of programs. It works very well for us. Our faculty love it. And we worked with a group, part of Senate Bill 242, formed a labor management committee to look at that. That bill presently is in the House Business and Labor Committee. I testified on it earlier this week. It passed unanimously in the Senate. Regarding debt ratios, you ask about that. The state has a debt advisory commission, and the debt portion of the audit, I want to make this very clear, was talking about general fund debt, the debt that is funded by the state general fund, right? We can ask for multiple types of bonds in our capital budget, and this is largely looking at the lottery fund debt as well as 11G, Article 11G debt that where you, through your graciousness and approvals, pay the debt service on those bonds. And it has been consuming a greater proportion of our state general fund allocation. Those allocations that have not kept pace with enrollment and other things. So that is absolutely important. The State Debt Advisory Commission, which has some legislators sitting on it, I can't remember the House member, but I know Senator Devlin sits on it, has a ratio that they use, and this is a debt burden calculation, where they don't want the debt service on those bonds to be more than 5% of the projected state general fund. And to date, I believe they've been successful in keeping that within those limits. We also can sell bonds, revenue bonds. We can sell Article 11F and other bonds that our institutions pay back for auxiliary type operations, building new dorms, parking garages, things like that. And our board has a 7% debt burden ratio, which is actually a best practice. It comes out of a higher ed ratio analysis book that is produced every year by KPMG. And 7% is an accepted threshold, i.e. they don't want any more than 7% of your operating expenses tied up in principal and interest payments on debt. And all of our institutions are well south of that. And in fact, on average, I think we're about 4% of that 7%, maybe 4.3% at the most. So that's their reserve levels. We use the Government Finance Officers Association, GFOA, recommended practice that we should maintain 5 to 15% of our operating budget in reserve at any point in time. Our board has a policy that, campuses should be in the 5 to 15% range with a target of 10, and should a campus fall below 5 or get above 15, they are to present a plan to the board on how they will regain that 10% position. Western Oregon has a slight exception to that due to the Promise Program that President Weiss mentioned earlier. The board felt they needed to have 10 to 20% because they don't have as much ability to control their pricing because they've made this promise to their students. And so we felt they should have a slightly higher reserve. But I do agree with Gary's comment that during volatile times, and GFOA agrees with this as well, you should maintain higher reserve levels when your revenue sources are less predictable or more volatile.
Jay, so where are we now for the other universities?
On
reserves. I mean,
by campus?
Yeah.
Chairman Dimbrough, you know, I can send that to you. It's in our reports. I want to say on average we're about 10, but some of our campuses are very close to the bottom, and some of our campuses may be slightly above the top.
Really?
And it's, you know, we've been growing rapidly, and institutions have not been able in all cases to hire faculty fast enough to keep up with the enrollment demand. And so there's a lag sometimes between when revenues are collected and when staffing is actually at a level that will maintain the quality that institution is striving to maintain.
If you could get it set, that would be great. And, you know, including the asterisks of, you know, why they might be at that level. I mean, if there's any contributing factors.
No, I'd be happy to do that.
That would be great. Thanks.
So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions or turn it back to Melody Partner.
Colleagues, questions?
I do have a question for you, Jay. And as we're in the process of devolving decisions to the campuses, you know, which is, you know, as you said and Kurt said, is the process that's been going on for a while, and is likely to increase. At the same time that you're devolving decision making, you do want to maintain some commonality of metrics, right? And, you know, to assess, I mean, going back to that question of assessing performance, and, you know, so that as you're looking at the decisions that individual campuses are making, you're comparing apples to apples, as it were. How do you deal with that tension? I mean, especially as, you know, if we're moving into an environment where universities are going to have their own boards, they may want to do their own kind of accounting, and they may, you know, the sort of standard things that we decide to track are judgments and probably are tied to our priorities. You know, we want, and I think you said that, is you have, you know, you don't have infinite resources, so you're going to kind of selectively choose what you're going to focus on to track. But yet it's really important for us in this body, and I think the public, you know, to be able to compare apples to apples. So how do you deal with that tension?
Chair Dimbrough, that's an excellent question, actually, and I'm going to answer it a couple different ways. One, through the generally accepted accounting principles that are followed by all of our universities, that kind of ensures everybody's roughly in that same zone. Now, you're absolutely right. There are interpretations. You know, when I was an accounting student as an undergrad, I loved my entry-level accounting because it was black and white, very pure. The debits had to equal the credits. But as I advanced into more complex topics, I began to learn that it was a little grayer than that. It wasn't black and white, and it required quite a bit of professional judgment and, in some cases, situational analysis. So, you know, my view, if we were to devolve into local entities or boards, is everyone's going to follow those same generally accepted accounting principles. Everyone's going to continue to report to IPEDS. There are certain standards that will guide and I think ensure a certain level of consistency in those data. The way we've dealt with it to date is we have one finance system, and there are some validation tables in that system that we control. We say everybody's going to have these same processing rules applied to those transactions, and so they are very much consistent. As we devolve that out, that's where some of this gray judgment could come into play, etc. But I think there are multiple ways of dealing with that. Audits is another way, making sure financial statements are presented fairly, etc. Institutional research. You know, it's interesting, if you look at the history of systems, we put the student information system in first. And actually, campuses got a little ahead of the chancellor's office back there. I was one of those. And we were waiting for the chancellor's office to create standards, you know, data definitions, etc. They didn't get it done. And so we put the system in, but they later found that by having a standard reporting format that they needed at the end of each four-week period or end of term, we could get consistent data. So they have kind of a crosswalk. Every institution ports data up to the chancellor's office. Bob Kieran, our director of institutional research, is a master then at putting that into common formats and consistent presentations. So there's different ways to do that depending how you choose, but I think happens every day in higher ed, happens every day in every business and industry across the country that I'm aware of.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kurt, I wanted to thank you for your service on the Board of Higher Education. Many years, a lot of work, travel, and I appreciate that very much, and non-paying job. We need people like you helping us in this system. Since we have the Chancellor here, would you comment on what little bit of money we do provide the university system about performance, donating that or providing that based upon performance? Some states are doing 100% on performance. Some are doing 90. I think the chair has got a bill. Are we talking about 30% in the state of Oregon? And even some states, if you have a minute to talk about, some states are trying to find a $10,000 degree that they're going to guarantee people. Would you have any comments on that?
Chair Dembro and Representative Wisnett, thank you very much for the questions. I'll try to touch each of them, and if I don't sufficiently, please be sure to circle back. So academic strategies is my background and area of expertise, and so these questions that have to do with reaping efficiencies on the academic side of the house are really my passion and what I hope to chat with you about today or at another point. This question of moving toward an outcomes-based, performance-based budget is something that is near and dear to all of our hearts, and actually Vice Chancellor Kenton has already pursued a process using external sources and experts to help us create exactly that budget form. So we are already in progress. We have representatives from all of the campuses helping us walk through what that would look like. And your question about the precise target is a very interesting question. And as you suggest, different states are using different percentages as they seek to really enhance performance-based outcomes for students. And what I would suggest about that is that best practice would recommend that we start low and over time increase. And the reason is that naturally you don't want to create an instability in our budgeting on any of our campuses and have major swings in reliability. In fact, not only is underfunding a problem for our institutions, but unstable funding is a major problem for our institutions. So we would not want to insert any kind of inconsistency into the system. So Jay could talk more deeply about this at another time if you wish more detail, but we're already on this. And one last thing I'll say on this question is that the Oregon University system has already been using incentive-based funding for the last biennium in particular around diversity initiatives. So we pushed money into the campuses based based on their metrics and performance on key diversity metrics, things that are very important to the state reaching 40-40-20. So we are very much supportive of performance outcomes-based funding and look to partner with all of you moving forward. On the question of the $10,000 degree.
We can do nine, can't we?
Lucy said for a nickel. Remember the senior commercial? Lucy says 5 cents.
Well, it's a fascinating question and one that's being debated. And, in fact, I was at the National Association of System Heads meeting the other day, and there were 20 of us around the table talking about exactly this point. And it won't be lost on you that the concern that academics like me have about setting a specific price point is the issue of quality. And I think Vice Chancellor Kenton has already suggested this to you. You all know the data. We have some of the lowest cost degrees in the nation. And what I worry about is that in the pursuit of low cost, we sacrifice quality. And we in the state must be talking about what do these degrees mean. So although we are entirely committed to helping move the state forward to closing the gap on our piece of the 40, we also must keep an eye to what is the content, what is the value of that degree at the end of the day, because quite honestly, if we sacrifice quality, those degrees will not help advance our economy, will not stabilize this state in the way in which we hope. So I think we need to approach that with great caution.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chancellor. And on Monday, Representative, we are going to be taking up the issue of the credit for prior learning or so. Yes.
Would you like to wrap up?
Yes. How much time do I have, Chairman?
Just a few, I think. But Rep. Johnson has a question.
Yes.
Because I want to let Gary come back up.
Not so much a question, I think, but just a comment. And I think, Madam Chancellor, I think in your opening comments, you made a statement that, that some of these, addressing the issues, i.e. cost drivers, cost savings, is really a collective effort. You know, we all have some responsibility, the legislative branch, the executive branch, OUS. Mm-hmm. We all have an obligation to work together. So what we've heard, and you know, I've heard it before today, obviously, is that, as you said, our cost per degree is exemplary, really, when you consider the disinvestment that's occurred, you know, from the legislature to you all, the cost drivers that obviously are an incredibly huge factor that has existed during that same time, that you're doing what you're doing with what you have or how little you have is really quite remarkable. So I just want to congratulate all of you. But
thank you.
I have a document that I asked our regionals for some information. I'd be happy to make this available to the rest of the committee if they're interested. But just as an example, the percentage of, as you look at the percentage of state allocation for each university and comparing that to the amount of PERS at each institution too. And obviously we've done some work on this week, but minus any reforms in fiscal year 13, 43% of the state allocation for Western would be consumed by PERS, and it goes up exponentially from there. So it's just an example of, I think, our obligation to actively do everything within our power, reasonably and fairly within our power, to help you all to be successful. So we're here to help. Thanks.
Chairman Dambro and Representative Johnson, thank you very much for that observation. And I have said it in other settings, and it won't come as any surprise to this committee, that we are very committed to PERS reform at OUS. We need PERS reform at OUS. And as I'm well aware of OSA sitting behind me, I will say there's a direct correlation between those expenses and what we have to pass along to students in the form of tuition. And this is a place where I think we collectively are deeply concerned. We know that given PERS reform at some level, we still expect tuition increases in the biennium of, you know, roughly 6%. We still have a tuition process to work through collaboratively with students and other stakeholders, but that's what we're looking at. If, on the other hand, we are not successful in reaping PERS reform at some level, we will have a much more difficult conversation on our campuses. And I can assure you, having been a first-generation college student myself who had the benefit of major state investment in me, 6% a year is untenable for many, many Oregonians, and precisely the Oregonians that we need to be seeking out to fill our gap in our 40. So it's of deep concern to all of us, and I appreciate your support, and ask that we be thinking about this as, again, as a set of stakeholders trying to get to a common outcome.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Melody. And I do have to follow up the you know, we could, Representative, we could come closer to a $10,000 degree if we would increase our allocation to the universities. And that will require us
I'm
to...
I'm all for that.
That will require us to get more revenue into the system to be able to increase the allocation that we're currently looking at. And that's what we're struggling with. And
we
will do... this committee will do its best. So thank you very much.
Yes,
and
thank you.
Gary, you want to come briefly back up? Thank you. And while we're doing this shift, you know, I do want to extend, you know, an invitation to people from OUS as well as from the Secretary of State that any advice you can give us as we're working on Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120, those governance changes, if there are things that should be in those bills to help us ensure that we do have that commonality of metrics. You know, that something be in there so that we can maintain the accountability of an overall system. I'd really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Just a couple little observations. I want to emphasize that we take on these kinds of audits because we think they're really critical aspects of state government that we're trying to figure out how they can better achieve their mission. And to that extent, the changes that are happening, you know, we're watching, we're pondering. We don't necessarily have all the answers to it, but from a devolving standpoint, I guess I feel like what we would hope is as the responsibilities and accountability changes that in the devolution, there are management systems in place that can respond to what we see as some very challenging emerging issues, not only in terms of increased costs for pension and health care, but declining state funds, challenges in competition from other universities in the country. Those are all things that all the universities are facing here, and especially in Oregon, and we want our universities to succeed. And what we look for, Jay Kenton talked about the detailed financial reporting that they do. The bottom line question I described that our auditors always ask is, what did you do with the money? And that's a whole bunch of different aspects of what public agencies do, but how does that get translated into what a student receives in terms of an education, and how can we make that more productive and more effective? So we look to management capacity is one of the ways to help agencies be efficient and effective, but secondly, to be nimble in these times when there are emerging issues and challenges that they need to face. So I'm hoping that, I guess, if I were to say one more thing to think about is making sure that as this devolution happens, that there are good management structures in place in the universities. And the tight loose, I'm not sure where that fits in management structure, but from our standpoint, we feel more comfortable with organizations that can draw that line of sight from where the dollars come from to what it results in terms of benefits for Oregonians. So that would be the only thing that I would add is that it's one more factor to think about is if you're assured that an organization is being well managed, it's easier to think about devolution. And if it's not, then it just needs more attention and more assurance. And I think we will probably find as we look at university by university, some are better managed than others. Some can benefit more from audits than others, and that happens in agencies around the state as well. So from our standpoint, we want to help in any way we can, regardless of the decisions that are made, to identify ways that your outcomes, your achievement compacts can actually create better results than anyone would have expected. So we offer our assistance.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gary. Okay, so with that, I will close this informational meeting. Colleagues, thank you very much for your patience. As a reward to you, you get to sleep in an extra 15 minutes on Monday morning.
15?
next week, we will begin at 8:45.
That's at least a half an hour.
And with that, I will close this hearing.